So Genesis, starting at verse 1 of chapter 23. Sarah lived 127 years. These were the years of the life of Sarah. And Sarah died at Kiriath Arba, that is Hebron, in the land of Canaan. And Abram went in to mourn for Sarah and to weep for her. And Abram rose up from before his dead and said to the Hittites, "I am a sojourner and a foreigner among you. Give me property among you for a burying place, that I may bury my dead out of my sight." The Hittites answered Abraham, "Hear us, my lord, you are a prince of God among us. Bury your dead in the choicest of our tombs. None of us will withhold from you his tomb to hinder you from burying your dead." Abram rose and bowed to the Hittites, the people of the land, and he said to them, "If you are willing that I should bury my dead out of my sight, hear me, and entreat for me Ephron, the son of Zohar, that he might give me the cave of Machpelah, which he owns. It is at the end of his field. For the full price, let him give it to me in your presence as property for a burying place." Now Ephron was sitting among the Hittites, and Ephron the Hittite answered Abraham in the hearing of the Hittites, all of who went in at the gate of the city, "No, my lord, hear me. I give you the field, and I give you the cave that is in it. In the sight of the sons of my people, I will give it to you. Bury your dead." Then Abraham bowed before the people of the land, and he said to Ephron in the hearing of the people of the land, "But if you will hear me, I give the price of the field. Accept it from me, that I may bury my dead there." Ephron answered Abraham, "My lord, listen to me. A piece of land worth 400 shekels of silver, what is that between you and me? Bury your dead." Abram listened to Ephron, and Abram weighed out for Ephron the silver that he had named in the hearing of the Hittites, 400 shekels of silver, according to the weights current among the merchants. So the field of Ephron in Machpelah, which was to the east of Mamre, the field with the cave that was in it, and all the trees that were in the field throughout its whole area, was made over to Abraham as a possession in the presence of the Hittites, before all who went in at the gate of his city. After this, Abraham buried Sarah, his wife, in the cave of the field of Machpelah, east of Mamre, that is Hebron, in the land of Canaan. The field and the cave that is in it were made over to Abraham as property for a burying place by the Hittites. Now the suggested title of today's message from your handout, it's "The Burial of a Friend." I'd already printed these. It's always difficult to find a meaningful name. And I printed these before I came out with what I think is a better name. But dying well is really what the core theme of this teaching is about today. So we're going to look at a little bit of the death of Sarah, who was Abraham's wife. Now death and dying, it's not one of the hot topics today. It's not often you turn the TV on at 6 o'clock and someone says, "We're going to tell you how to die well." It doesn't happen very often. We don't see it discussed much anywhere, in fact. Categorically, we don't see it discussed much anywhere. Except, I think, there's probably a little bit of quiet discussion in aged care facilities and places like that. But in general, the world doesn't want to talk about death and dying. In fact, there's a book I was reading that suggested nobody talks about death, and in fact, they talk about everything else but death. It would appear that Victorian England, they actually did speak about death a great deal, and we know that they spoke about sex and related matters very little. Today it's the opposite. No one wants to talk about death, but the TV and the media and the web and all the signs and everything is full of that other topic that belies our sense of modesty. So I wanted to find out if this book was true. I looked in Amazon, I did a search about dying and death. The result was 3 pages, each with I think 20 results per page. And at the front of that, there were 8 or 10 Christian titles. Keller, Carson, and a few others. And literally nothing else about dying, death, how to approach that. There is very little literature about dying and death. I kept searching. I did a search on abortion and I found 20 plus pages, innumerable pages, on how to go about abortion, how to survive abortion, how to feel better and recover from abortion. Yeah? This is like 10 times the amount of material on death. I tried euthanasia and I got the same result. I was absolutely flabbergasted. Page after page, there are lists of books about murder and suicide. But there is very little about how to approach death. See, today's world, the idea of dying well, it may even be uncomfortable for some of us here today. The notion of thinking about dying well, it's a difficult topic. And instead, the world will spend its time and resources and all of its programs to talk about anything else. Death itself and the conversation about death has become taboo. So there was a time not so long ago, I think one of the underlying reasons for this is that it wasn't that long ago where the majority, at least in the West, if you read the literature and the poetry and the arts and all of those things, not so long ago the majority believed they had a sense of immortality. They had an understanding that this was not the end. The majority of people accepted that. Both culturally and intellectually, they understood that there's something else. This is not, even if they're not Christians, they knew, they had a spoken of understanding of something else after this life, something after death. But with the rise of the myth of evolution and the heavy-handed tactics today, and we've seen this over the last few decades of atheists, strong atheists, there's a growing disbelief in anything past this life. 70 in the grave, done. Where random molecules join together that participate in some, I don't know, some ethereal universal aspect, and then it's all over. And that is becoming more and more the mainstream. Now, if there is nothing after this life, why would you care to talk about dying well? It's just random things. That's just what's going to happen. Live with it. Yeah? People don't talk about it because that's a ghastly topic to be speaking of. When you have absolutely no hope, and no hope of anything better after this life, and if you even deny the existence of something after this life, the idea of talking about death and dying well, it's a repulsive idea. Not so in the Christian church. The Christian church and the Bible that tells the Christian church what to believe has knowledge about next life. And that's, I want to address the implications of that today. We're going to find three main themes. The first has to do with grief. And I alluded to that back at the beginning about John 11:35, where even our Saviour expressed a grief. We should not be like Stoics that think there's a loved one gone and that's the end of it and we don't need to be emotionally involved. The second point I want to make has to do with Abraham's acquisition of a piece of land, which is actually, it's a manifestation of Abraham's faith in the promise that God made. And we'll talk more about that when we get there. And the third relates to this overarching theme of how can we die well. Now this comes from Genesis 23, this lesson, and clearly it focuses on Sarah's death. Abraham's buying a plot, and then there's a summary conclusion where she's buried and that remembrance is done. To introduce the story, I want to quote Gordon Wenham, because in his commentary he makes some extremely clear points about the life of Sarah. Have a listen to what he says. After Eve, Sarah is the first woman of import to tread the stage of Genesis. From Cain to Babel, the primeval history preserves an almost exclusively male orientation. Women are rarely mentioned except as adjuncts to their husbands. But with Sarah, we meet a woman of heroic proportions, worthy grandmother of the nation of Israel. Now, her life was far from easy. She suffered the shame of childlessness till she was 90. Twice she was trapped in a foreign king's harem by her husband's unbelieving folly. Twice she was provoked beyond breaking point by the slave girl Hagar and her son Ishmael. Once she learned of her husband's attempt to sacrifice her birth son on an altar to God. From the way her husband treated her, sometimes we may begin to ask or wonder whether he really cared about his wife at all. Yeah? Was he not more interested in preserving his own skin and sometimes serving God than he was in his wife? The stories of the expulsion of Ishmael and the sacrifice of Isaac, when you go back and read those stories, they highlight Abraham's deep affection for his sons. And today, chapter 23, we begin to see, and it makes plain, Abraham's sincere love and devotion to his wife Sarah and the honour that he bestowed on her. So I thought that was a nice prelude, so that we have a bit of a background for thinking about Sarah. I also note that she's the only woman in the whole of scriptures where her age is mentioned. Only once that's ever happened. And I don't think any woman has ever wanted her age to be known ever since. It seems to be a precedent that he set. She was the wife of Abraham, and she was, as we just looked, she's been through thick and thin with Abraham. Ups, downs, great leaps of faith, and then valleys of disbelief and sin. And Abraham's life partner here in our story today, she succumbed to the pangs of death 37 years after the birth of Isaac. Now, while Sarah was complicit in some of that sin on some occasions recorded in Genesis and many others that would not have been recorded, yet we see that the whole of her life was one of walking in faith with God. You didn't see that come out of chapter 23, did you? It doesn't anywhere say in there. Listen to what the Hebrew writer says. Describing the patriarchs and matriarchs of old, he said, by faith, Sarah herself, this is Hebrews 11, received power to conceive. By faith, Sarah received power to conceive, even when she was past the age, since she considered him faithful who had promised. Therefore, from one man and him as good as dead were born descendants of as many as the stars of heaven and as many as the innumerable grains of sand. These all died in faith, not having received the things promised, but having seen them and greeted them from afar, and having acknowledged that they were strangers and exile in the earth. The Hebrew writer is writing about Sarah, and he says she had faith and received power to conceive, and she considered him, that is God, faithful who had promised. Now that's the summary that the Hebrew writer gives to the life of Sarah. It's very different from twice in different harems, Ishmael, Hagar, tensions, conflicts, sin, wrong, crazy behaviour. Far different from that. That's not what's recorded in this Hebrews passage. And here we have, in our story today, Abram and Sarah, been married a long time. We have the earliest description of what it looks like when the bond between the two that have joined and become one, we get a description of what that looks like when it's broken, when it's severed. Yeah? None are exempt from this end, because as the Bible clearly teaches, man is appointed once to die, and after that is judgment. And as is evidenced in the testimony of our own lives and the passing of time in this life. Whilst death, and this is an important point, whilst death is inevitable, it's that place that every single living human being must come to, yet there is something inside us that tells us that this is not the way it should be. Something within our image of God-made beings, we know that this is not how it's supposed to end. This is an unwelcome visitor This is that, you know, I don't like the Grim Reaper picture because I don't think that's a scriptural way to view it, but this is that event that just should not be. If you go back to the Garden of Eden, before sin, it was not. If you want to know why we die, it's because of sin, both spiritually and physically. We each one know that we're beings of a different order. We're beings that are made in that wonderful image of God. And death itself is a separation of what should never be separated. If Adam and Eve had persevered with no sin in obedience to God, they would have remained in their mortal, in their physical and their spiritual bodies together, body and soul united forever. Death separates the soul from the body. That can't be right. That's something broken. Something's terribly wrong. And it's here that we have that reason to sit and ponder. And we'll look a little bit now at our first point, and that is the grieving of Abraham. See, we saw in verse 2, we see Abraham, he went in to mourn for Sarah and to weep for her. And we can picture this as going to the funeral home, I guess, because there the body is. And he's gone into a tent where this body's lying, and he's viewed his beloved, and then he's mourned and he's wept. He would have done the customary as well. That is, he would have torn his robe, shaved his beard, ashes on his head, dishevelment. All in the act of mourning for his wife, Sarah. As I said before, there's a view today that Christians are supposed to be impervious to loss and suffering, and we should stand tall and rise above all such things. Yeah? And keep a smiley face. Yeah? Everything is so joyful. That is, many today will teach an unwritten motto: real Christians don't cry. Yeah? Certainly not real Christian men. You lost your job. Oh, isn't the Lord just good? Isn't he so good? You've got cancer. Oh, praise God, you're going to be with him sooner. Isn't that wonderful? Your mother died. You must be happy she's going to be with the Lord now, are you? These are the wrong ways to see trauma and tragedy in our lives. Of course, we should continue in our trust in him for all things. There should be a deep subterranean source of joy in your life. That is Christ. He should be the wellspring that elevates you above your circumstances, but our circumstances, because we're human, our circumstances will drag us in, and we will be close, and we will mourn. Being a Christian doesn't mean that we don't experience pain and sadness and loss. What it does mean is that it's not the end. There is that deep knowledge of Christ. There is that well of living water for the Christian that will work with us and bring us back up out of our anguish and pain. Of course, there's no such thing as a stoic happiness in Abraham's life. He went in to mourn and to weep for Sarah. It was also the experience of many others, many other saints in the scriptures, and of course, as it was with Jesus in the reading that we had earlier on. One hymn writer, Adelaide Proctor, put it like this, just a couple of lines from an 1858 hymn. I thank thee more that all our joy is touched with pain, that shadows fall on the brightest hours, that thorns remain. She knew that this life, it has its highs, but she was grateful for those deep, scarring things that came into her life because it only painted the life and the love of Christ even clearer. Our lives may be great and wonderful and full of family and love and grandchildren and successes, but we have here a reminder that there are many prickly thorns amongst us, and death comes, and it will bring with it sadness and mourning. So that's our first point. There is a solid basis for why Christians should mourn the loss of their loved ones. They should be grounded in a compassion and a knowledge that this is not the way it should be. So Abraham is mourning, and his sadness persists for a while. Now, he's in a real predicament. Abraham and Sarah were strangers in a foreign land. 60 years since he was called from Ur of the Chaldeans. And if we read the passage in verse 4 in that reading from Genesis 23, he says, "I am a sojourner and a foreigner among you." Now that's, in essence, that's his predicament. He's got Sarah, his wife, has died. He wants to preserve some sort of dignity and respect for her, and he wants to bury her in a place of permanence. But he's a sojourner and a foreigner. He doesn't even own a piece of dirt. Yeah? He's here with Sarah, and they've been moving around, living mostly around this Ai of Bethel in that area, and he's still living in tents. In fact, the word, the original language underneath that, "I am," it actually is the other way around. The actual original says, "An alien and a stranger am I," just to emphasise that point. He had no home yet. Now recall God's promises. "I will make of you a great nation, and lift up your eyes and look from the place where you are, northward, southward, eastward and westward. For all the land that you see I will give to you and your offspring forever." That was out of Genesis 13. But we find he's still living in a tent, and the promise is not, he can't even see the reality yet. He didn't even have a plot, nowhere to bury his beloved Sarah. So he goes to the owners, the occupiers of the land, the Hittites, and he asks for a plot in which he can bury the dead. And then we have this rather detailed, backwards and forwards, this rather detailed explanation of the process. They wanted to give him a block, take the choicest, although I don't quite know what the choicest of burial plot looks like, but there must be some way to define that. And they wanted to give him a block for nothing, but that didn't suit Abraham for a number of reasons. One, they could claim to be his benefactor. Yeah. Two, they could hold him accountable into the future for some maintenance or something around where this grave site was. And three, we learned from an earlier discussion and story in Genesis that he wanted God only to be his benefactor and to be accountable to God and to not have anyone else say, "We made you rich, we made you prosper." Yeah? He wanted to put God into that place only. So let's look at the conversation. The Hittites, which is today's Turkey, that whole conversation that was made on very amicable grounds, and it's true to this day, that in many parts of Oriental, in Egypt and many parts around that area, this is exactly how they negotiate. It still persists to this day. And all it is a business deal. There's nothing astronomical about this. It's simply the description of a business deal. Unfortunately, many have read lots of things into this passage, but the reality is, it is just the way they did business then, and in many parts continue today. The negotiation is in three phases. First, he says, "Give me some property." He makes his request. The Hittites reply, "Well, none of us would hinder you." Yeah, an element of compassion is shown. "Of course we would not prevent you. Bury your wife. Yeah, this is a sad time for you." And Abram's request then came for a specific cave, Ephron's cave, which is the cave of Machpelah, which he owns, and it's the end of a field. Now, Ephron agreed and said, "Sure, I'll give it to you. You can have the thing. No need to worry about money." Then Abram offers to pay, "But if you will hear me, I give the price of the field." He doesn't want that accountability to a foreign land. Yeah? Ephron names his price, and when he does so, there's a lot of mixed, how people interpret this is mixed in the different commentaries. Some say it was an exorbitant price, and that Ephron was being a bit loose with his words. What's 400 shekels between mates? Just pay up, subtly. Yeah? But others say no, it was just the normal trading price, because we can't actually trace back to find out. And It's just a plain business deal. So Ephron names his price. He owns it, but he doesn't want Abram to have just the cave. For some reason, he wants to be shot of the whole field. He wants to give him this whole field. So the way Ephron responded when he said, you know, what's 400 shekels between friends? You're the prince of God in our land. When he says those things, it may well be their way of saying, well, actually, I want to sell the whole field. Yeah? He wasn't prepared to give it away at all. He wanted to sell the whole field. So all of these dealings have been before the men of the community. Probably it sounds like it's at the gates to an area where there is some settlement. And we know that that's where the notables gather. And we see how Abram once more avoids being put at the disposal of foreigners. He pays full price. And he does so in a public space. And of course we learn from that the need to be careful and scrupulous in our business dealings when we buy and sell anything. And if it's of consequence, to have it witnessed. Yeah? Before the land itself. Formally, correctly. Now let's just go back and see his desire, Abram's desire here was to owe gratitude and obedience to God and to God alone. God is the one who has promised him all things. God is the one who has been faithful and given him a son, Isaac. Yeah? So his faith and his desire now is pointing him to be owing a gratitude to God alone. Let's look at that verse 4 again. I am a sojourner and a foreigner among you. He's lived here for more than 50 years, but he's got no land, no place to call home. He can't even say, I'm an Australian. He has no nationality. Yeah? He has only a promise. So he's a nomad and a visitor. It begs us to ask the question, why would he be prepared to spend a fairly large amount of money to buy a piece of land in a place that he doesn't have any other ownership? Why would he just buy a burial plot? Why not buy a few acres for his house and his farm? Why not buy a few hundred acres for his sheep? Why did he spend money on this large amount of money to purchase a burial plot? Those motives are found to be totally grounded in his faith in the promises of God. This whole land, north, south, east and west, is promised to Abraham. And when we look at the words that he used in that narrative to describe the land, the thing that he's purchased, we come across this phrase in verse 9. It says, give it to me in your presence as property for a burying place. The underlying Hebrew word burying place is akuza, and it carries the idea of an inheritance. Abraham has used that phrase twice in this narrative. He's spoken those words twice in verse 9 and verse 20. And that circumscribes this business dealing relationship. What's his motive? He's actually buying a down payment on his inheritance. God has promised him the whole thing. He knows he's going to get the whole thing. In confidence, he's taking a practical step to acquire a part of that so that he has a burial place. It's an act of faith. He's purchasing in anticipation of a future promise that will become a reality. His eyes are looking by faith at the future when his progeny would own this entire land as far as he could see, north, south, east and west. Interestingly, when we read through the rest of Genesis, we find that Isaac, Rebekah and Jacob and Leah are all buried in the cave of Machpelah. It becomes the burial ground for his immediate family. So what he's doing here is he's paying for and claiming literally a down payment on a future promise. He acquired the first fruits of the promised land. His eyes are fixed on that very promise of God, the future state into which God has promised he would come. Now that says something to us, our eyes too. For the believer, for the Christian, our eyes should be focused intently, where? on the things above, not on the things of this earth. Our attention should be drawn to, our attention, our desires, our very being should be drawn to those heavenly things that endure forever. The love of God, the work of Christ, the worship of that God. That's what should be our driving force, not how many properties we can acquire, how nice is our car, yeah? But our attention should be drawn to something far more glorious, not on the things that are corruptible. We come to our third and final point, that of dying well. Now, well, we might look and say, how do we know that Sarah died well? When you think about what Gordon Wenham described as Sarah's life, yeah, she had a varied, quite a variety of experience in life. Much of it was traumatic. How do we then know that she died well? Where's the evidence that she's passed from this life and actually entered that life of rest in the bosom of her God? Look again at that Hebrews passage. Hebrews 11, verses 11 to 13. By faith, Sarah, she herself received power to conceive, even when she was past the age, since she considered him faithful who had promised. Now there's a couple of very strong pointers. Sarah considered God who was faithful, that God, she considered him to be faithful. Then look at verse 13. These all died in faith, and this is the crux for us. The first bit, in verse 11, we find the evidence that she died well because she considered God faithful. In verse 13, we see, what does that mean to us? These all died in faith, not having received the things promised. That's where we are. We know what we're going to get. We know what the expectation is. We know that this life comes to a physical end, and then we're at the foot of the throne of Christ in heaven, worshipping with the angels forever. We know that's coming, but we're not there yet. Not having received the things promised, but having seen them and greeted them from afar. Now that's a most precious statement. Do you preciously treasure and greet that time? Do you look forward to when you will be with Christ himself? Do you look forward to being able to sing his praises in his very courts? A God-inspired author of the New Testament book of Hebrews has declared that Sarah, one, had faith, two, considered God to be faithful, three, died with those things in her mind. That was her passion. For even though she had not received, yet she seen them from afar off and greeted them. And I think that's truly a wonderful passage to model our lives on. To see the promises, and if you haven't seen them clearly, get your Bibles out. Read, study, meditate. Get books around it. Learn what is that future state. See it from afar off with clarity. And let the love of God and the Christ who gave his life for you, let those things draw your entire life and desires to that time. Does that describe you? And that's a serious question. Is that where your great hopes lie? Or are your feet still solidly planted in this world and the acquisition of things and stuff and the pursuit of other people and friendship and all those things? Is your primary core focus? Do you still have feet of clay? Or are you looking with great hope and anticipation for that time in the future? Are you greeting the wonders of our future full on? Does your joy increase when you ponder the depth of love that God has for his people, such that he would give his only son to die in your place. Will he, will that Jesus Christ, at the final hour when he comes back as Lord, ruler, sovereign King of all things, will he say to you, "Well done, good and faithful servant"? I pray that that is the case. Let's join together and sing our final hymn.